Welcome to the Better Birth Podcast. My name's Erin and I'm a hypnobirthing and antenatal instructor, birth activist and all-round birth geek. In this podcast, I chat to experts in the field of pregnancy and birth, debunking myths around birth, diving into the research around maternity care and exploring what is it that means you're more likely to have a positive birthing experience. If you enjoy this podcast, do feel free to buy me a coffee and fund my caffeine habit. Link to my Buy Me a Coffee page is in the podcast info. Enjoy this episode. Welcome to the Better Birth Podcast. I am very, very honoured to have the very wonderful Sophie Messager back again to come and talk today. Welcome, Sophie.
Thank you, Erin. I'm delighted to be back.
I'm very excited to talk to you today because we are going to be talking about the ageing placenta myth, which is something that I think a lot of people are told, and it's a massive myth that I feel like we need to explore more. You've been on the podcast previously because you came on and recorded an episode with me on Rebozo. So if people haven't listened to that, they need to go and listen to that episode as well. But before we start, do you want to just introduce yourself for anybody that didn't hear the last episode on who you are and what you do?
Sure. So I'm Sophie Messager. As you can hear from my accent, I'm French, but I've been living in the UK for 25 years. And my background is I spent 20 years doing research. I have a PhD in physiology of reproduction. And then the birth of my children, 17 years, the first child 17 years ago, led me to want to retrain and to become somebody who supported people to have basically the experience I had, which I had a doula, and I went from being really scared of birth to having a fantastic experience, fantastic empowered experience of giving birth. And in fact, when I reflect, I know that there's no way I would have had that experience if I hadn't put the support in place, you know, the education support in place, because I had no idea what I was up against, which is the theme I'm sure we'll cover in this discussion. And so I'm a bit of a jack of all trades, yeah, and I love learning new things. You know, I ended up training to be a doula, I ended up training to be an antenatal teacher, baby wearing instructor, and then being at birth led me to train to want to explore the energy side of things. So I trained to be a Reiki practitioner and then a Reiki drum practitioner, and both in the teaching field in that and as well. And I kind of organically fell into teaching professional rather than parents. It kind of happened over time, and I found myself acquiring a lot of skill like rebozos, closing the bone. Rituals is my big topic now, you know, mother blessings, postpartum wrapping, lots of stuff that came from learning techniques, you know, tradition and rituals that belong to cultures that still have nurturing traditions around the perinatality, and seeing what we had in the UK as a huge contrast. And then I ended up writing a book, Why Postnatal Recovery Matters, because I got fed up of seeing women struggle in the postpartum and blame themselves for the struggle when really what we have is not at all appropriate. And because of my background, I've made it a specialty to blend science and traditional knowledge. And I've also made it a specialty, which is what we're discussing today, to go and challenge a lot of the beliefs, scientific beliefs that are taken for granted inside the system, because I can analyze it, you know, can go and look at the thing and go, doesn't add up.
So, and, and there's a lot, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of guidelines, policies and beliefs that should be challenged and could be challenged. I mean, we could do a whole podcast series just on,
just on that.
But we are going to focus on placentas and the aging of placentas for today's episode. And like I said, I do think this is a really important topic to cover, because like we said, I said to you before we started recording, I mean, honestly, if I had a pound for every client that got told you have to have an induction because you're, you know, post-date and your placenta is going to stop working, I would be rich. Like, yep. Not even clients. I have people dropping into my DMs on Instagram constantly saying I've been told my presenter is going to fail. It is a very common reason. I'm doing air quotes reason for induction because it's not really a reason. Alongside all the other raft of again reasons for induction.
Alongside the baby being too big, and say either your placenta is failing or your baby's getting too big, or be both together.
Baby's too big, baby's too small, you're too old, you're too fat, there's you have the wrong ethnicity. I mean, there's a laundry list of reasons that someone might get offered an induction. So I mean, where do we start with talking about this topic? You know, is it a valid concern, I guess? Is it a reason for induction? Do placentas just pack up after 40?
So I believe that placentas do pack up, although pack up is probably not the right term, but I don't believe that they pack up. I think I can have problems at any, some placenta can have problem at any point in the pregnancy, but the idea that somehow because you reach 38, 39, 40, 41 weeks, 42 weeks, because you reach a set date, somehow your placenta goes, ah, it's midnight, I need to turn into a pumpkin. It's just, sorry, I'm actually quoting Dr. Sarah Wickham on that. She said your placenta doesn't turn into a pumpkin. That doesn't make any sense, you know. But I think we need to backtrack a little bit, because one of the things that took me years to understand, and is such a source of frustration because I am so obsessive with knowledge and so curious, it took me years to understand why people in the system didn't question guidelines. And people in the system don't question guidelines because that's not how the system is set up in any way. Each individual cannot be blamed for that, because the way that, you know, maternity care works like a medieval church. You've got a nice guideline, the Pope, yeah, and then the guidelines get passed on. Also, what's really funny is each individual hospital makes up their own guidelines, because of course each individual inside the hospital interprets what's been issued by NICE their own perspective, which is fascinating, because you know the guidelines for, say, waters broken in Oxford Hospital are completely different from the one in Cambridge Hospital. So there is that phenomenon that, you know, the other thing I discovered through the years is that there's three types of health professionals: the ones who think the guidelines are good, the rules are good, and follow them because they think they're good; the ones that think they're not especially good, and they follow them, they disrespect them, like covertly. So the midwives who say, at a home birth, when I said, "Well, you know, how did you get away with letting the mother push for 3 hours instead of what it says is new guidelines, which is two?" They say, "I don't record the pushing until I can see the head." And then the third category are the people who overtly challenge the system, and those people get removed. That's it. And once you understand that, you can't blame the people, because the system actively punishes. You know, if anything goes wrong, they're going to come on the person like a ton of brick if they've taken any liberty with what the rule says. And it's harmful for people in the system, and it's harmful for the professional, and harmful for the people who are being cared for in the system. So I think it's really important to look at that. And then above that, even, is the fact we live in a patriarchy, and we think that, and again, it's not conscious. I don't think people are doing it through harm. They genuinely think that they're being helpful. But the whole concept of how medical care, education, and politics are set up in the Western world, is that, you know, you don't know. And education is really clear. It's like, and to a level, parenting. So we're set up to be doing as we're told, right? It's like you don't know what's right for you. The experts do, and you go and ask your doctor, you go and ask your teacher, you go and ask your mentor, you go and ask somebody above you who knows what's right for you, and the whole concept of that. Because, you know, when the people who are studying the aging placenta, I believe they genuinely think that they're being helpful. You know, they think they're saving lives. But, you know, we've come to a completely crazy point where I've read papers when I was, so in the last few days, I've been rereading what's been published since I first wrote the blog because I wanted to make sure that what I'm talking about is still based on evidence. And I found papers that say, American papers that say that, oh, yes, since induction of labor carries much less risk than before and it's very safe, we should really be inducing any women over 40 weeks because the risk of waiting versus the risk of inducing really say that it's in favor of the induction, but that's because it's a very skewed view. And of course, very few of those pieces of research go and ask the actual people to whom we're going to do the induction what their experience is. You know, do they like the idea? Like, there was this big study that was done when they'd really struggled. I can't remember the name of that study, with a big study on induction. I think it was a 39 something trial. And they really struggled to recruit people who would consent to be induced early for the sake of the study. That tells you something.
I think it's interesting, the whole view about the patriarchy and how it affects not just birth, but women's healthcare, in general. And I've got into arguments with people over this, over social media, which I was talking to you about earlier. People saying that, it's not the patriarchy and it's man-hating. And I think a lot of it is unconscious. It's a societal belief, and there's so much that goes on in the background that we don't know, we don't consider in terms of research. And the selective way that things are researched, and how we decide what to research, or how those studies are conducted. I found it really interesting. I saw on I think it was on TikTok actually, that the first study ever to look at the absorbency of period products with actual blood rather than water was this year, and it discovered that all of the claims that period products make about the absorbency of all their products are wrong because
Of
they were using
course,
water instead of blood.
very different viscosity
Yeah,
and
completely different. And it's taken till 2023 to actually test the
but
absorbency
we
of period
still, it's only very recently that period products have adverts have switched to using red liquid instead of
products.
blue.
Instead of blue, yeah. So I think it's, that absolutely undeniable that the patriarchy affects birth and it affects policies and it affects guidelines and it affects our decision-making processes as pregnant people because on a subconscious level we are conditioned to comply or to agree or to listen and to do what we're told. And so when you have a obstetrician saying to you should be induced, or you have to be induced because your placenta is going to fail. You don't want a dead baby, do you? I think most people do go, oh God, no, you're the expert. You know what you're talking about. All this research, absolutely, that's fine. Book me in for the induction.
And you know what really gets my goat here is that implying for one second that somebody who's pregnant is going to willingly endanger the life of their baby is ridiculous. Because we know from all the research that women make safe choices. And the big difference is if you give people the space to decide for themselves, they may consent to whatever is being offered, but they're going to feel completely different than if they're feeling being steamrolled. And the dead baby card, which you just quoted, it angers me so much. I mean, I have been at births where somebody said, "Your placenta is failing right now." Like, how do you know? Do you have things to measure the failing of the placenta while somebody's in labor? I had some client who discharged herself against medical advice when she was still pregnant because they'd been told telling her she had low amniotic fluid. And as she walked away from the ward, the midwife said to her, "I hope you don't have a stillbirth in the night."
That's disgusting.
And the thing is, she told a story in front of another friend, and her friend gasped, and I didn't, because I've heard it before. The dead baby card, the coercion, the sort of. And so many times I've had women saying to me, "I don't want to get induced," especially when the induction is for the looming 42 weeks. But I wouldn't forgive myself if something happened to the baby. And that's a possibility you may have to live with, yeah? Because we never know. Nothing is guaranteed. Nothing is 100%. And the guilt, but also how society is going to judge you. You know, being, it takes a lot of strength to make decisions, knowing that there's that weight. And sometimes I've had clients who said to me, I really don't want to get induced. I know my baby is safe, but my partner is so scared.
Yeah.
I'm going to consent. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go ahead because I couldn't live with myself if anything happened to the baby. And I'd gone against my partner's wishes. So it's a minefield. You know, I remember being myself 42 weeks and 2 days pregnant with my first child. And I was very lucky back then to have, you know, this 2006, and I had a NHS midwife. I had the same midwife all the way through. She would come to my house for some of the appointments, and she was a very experienced Scottish midwife, was very down to earth and was just reassuring me instead of, because I told her right from the start I didn't want to get induced. But, you know, in that vulnerable situation, you doubt yourself, right? So if anybody starts, when you're already feeling anxious and pressured by time, because, you know, how does that help somebody go into labor when they know that if they haven't had the baby by midnight on 42 weeks, they can no longer, for instance, go to the birth center, even though since then I've actually had clients going there at 43 weeks because when you know better, you give people tools to be able to call the bluff and say, well, that's okay, I'm not coming in. Please send me a midwife at home. And suddenly the birth placenta doors open. But, you know, the sort of how it's very rare to meet, you know, when people get to 40, close between 41 and 42 weeks, usually you get a consultant appointment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's random, right? You get some, I've been amazed by it, who were very balanced and said things like, we're here to decide whether you want to wait, whether you want to have an induction, whether you want to have a cesarean. And I know the research is full of holes, but, you know, but then again, more often than that, I see your placenta is filling right now. In fact, I had a consultant make a formal complaint against me once because I said that it was the first day of my period. I'd just written the blog. And I went with a client who happened to be a really good friend of mine with us, who was herself a doula. And she wanted a home birth, and she did not want to get induced. And this consultant said, Brian, your placenta is failing right now. And because I was on day one of my cycle, before I had time to control my mood, my out of my mouth came, well, I've got a PhD in biology and 20 years or so. I've reviewed all the evidence and there isn't any. And this consultant's face was a picture. And she said, well, I disagree with you. And the guidelines say, that's what people always fall back on.
Yeah.
The guidelines, like it's gospel, you know, like it's some kind of holy text.
This is the problem with guidelines, because you can cherry pick research to back up guidelines, or you can cherry pick research which is going to support the policies and guidelines that you want to put in place. There can be a whole raft of other research that you know says the opposite.
Yeah.
But all a consultant needs to do is say, well, here's the research study, this is, and then they've backed up their recommendation, and they've given you the evidence and they've given you the policy. And as a pregnant person, it's very hard then to go, well, actually, no, okay. Which is why I wanted to do this podcast episode, because, you know, I think people need balance when you're being told these things by someone in a white coat. You know, it's very hard to push back.
And in fact, one thing I always tell people who ask me when they're in a situation is not to ever come back at the medical professional with research, because that always backfires. People will poke holes into. So when people say to me, oh, I've got this appointment with a consultant again tomorrow, so I'm going to bring all these papers. No. You don't need to justify your choice. You're not a health professional. So throw the ball back in their camp. You know, but just don't go there, because I always remind people that if they were pregnant with triplets and they wanted to give birth in a field, they would. That's within their rights, you know. So,
I mean, at the end of the day, as a pregnant person, You don't have to justify your choices, even if they go against guidelines or policy or research, or even if you haven't read the research and you just want to do X, Y, Z. You don't have to justify it. You don't have to persuade, or convince the midwife or the obstetrician. It's your choice.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But so for a very different approach, obviously, is for the person who is that way inclined, knowing that there's research that actually questions the guideline when the guideline goes against their wishes is can be very empowering. Not for everyone, because there's people for whom reading research might actually be harmful, like people who find reading being too much into their head. And when I was training, when I did my degree in antenatal education, I was amazed because most people like you and me, Irene, we're what we call monitors. So we want as much information, give it to me, all of it, please, information, more information. But there are people called blunters for whom too much information is harmful. So you need to be really careful how, I always tell my clients, would you like to read more papers? Would you like this? But for the people for whom it's helpful, it's important for them to know that it's not as clear cut as the guidelines say. And let's not forget that the guidelines are created by people. Usually NICE guidelines is a panel of people, and there's not people like us in there. It's a panel of people who are medics, who are scientists, who are. Their mode of thinking is very different from the approach that we're talking about, which is one where you put the person in charge, where you put the person at the center of the decision making, at the center of the experience. And I think the people who are constitute the panels that issues the guidelines, they are blind to that themselves,
So, what happens to the placenta as the pregnancy progresses, and why do you think that people or obstetricians or medical professionals will say that the placenta is going to fail? What things are they looking at, and how do they justify that claim?
Yeah, so they look at markers of aging, right? So they look at things like, if I use jargon, apoptosis is one. This is basically programmed cell death. They looked at markers of inflammation. They look at marks of oxidative stress. There's a whole flurry. I'm not going to name them all, but there's the same terms come back over and over and over in all the papers. And I guess, if you only have a hammer, everything starts to look like a nail. So people who are looking for this, they are actively looking for sign of aging that they interpret as aging. And when I started looking into the papers in details, what I saw was that, for instance, and I go into very much detail in the blog, so if anybody's listening to this want to read the blog has linked to the research inside of it. I've tried to put as much as I could in there. That the first thing that really struck me was, because of my background in science, that apoptosis, which is programmed cell death, some people call it cell suicide, I remember very well back in my days of being a student in biology that we were told that apoptosis was, for instance, necessary for the shaping of the brain or the spinal cord and other parts of the body in the fetus whilst it's growing. And that you've got apoptosis again when you're going through puberty. And I'm pretty sure, but although I'm not aware that's been studied, that you've got apoptosis again when you go through the whole pregnancy, motherhood thing. There's so much remodeling in the brain. And I'm sure you have it when you go through menopause as well. So apoptosis, programmed cell death, is as much of a marker of change and growth as it is a marker of aging. And when I wrote the blog, I went back and thought, okay, that dates back from my study, so I want to go back. And I found very recent papers that said the same thing, that they were papers not in the field of maternity care, but papers talking about those things in general as a and not as not being, it wasn't clear cut to call them signs of aging. And I assume that people who are talking about that, they don't go back and think, oh, hang on a bit, this is not as simple as So the new aspect, so I looked at every single of those things and I was like, doesn't you can't say it's just a theory. I think one of the big points, that's the main point I'm making in the blog, is that it's a theory, the aging. And when you delve into each of the individual paper, even in the what I found with one of the latest review, which is from 2020, says, you know, they don't have the data to. They don't have the. They think this is likely that it means that, but we don't have proof. They say that in their own papers, but the title doesn't say that. The title always go, aging of the placenta is responsible for stillbirth. You know, aging of the placenta in older mothers is responsible for this and that, and aging of the placenta in IVF. You know, and it's all these categories. Always goes this is that, and then when you delve to the actual paper, they themselves say, we think that it's this, we think that it's that, but they don't have proof. Actual black and white proof is not there. And the thing that really amused me greatly, because one of the theory I made in the when I wrote the original blog in 2019 was, what if those changes are actually needed changes that need to happen for the birth to start, for instance? And I found a paper from 2022 that is interestingly called Aging of the Placenta. I've emailed the author saying, you know, can you give me the reference for that? But I've not received a re review, so I've done my own research. In there's that one sentence that really struck me. It's a paper that says placenta age, but there's also a paragraph in the paper without reference that says that it's also a known thing that placentas undergo changes to facilitate the detachment of the placenta at the moment of birth. And that got me into some major rabbit holes because I went like, well, okay, so there's some cellular processes, which makes a lot of sense, because to think that it's just a contraction, only a mechanical process, that doesn't make any sense. So that there is a change in the extracellular matrix inside the structure of the placenta that kind of prepares the placenta to more easily detach, just the same way as the cervix need to dissolve the collagen in there to allow it to open. And I found some studies, I've not found studies in humans, and I found some studies in bovine, but I know that they have slightly different placenta from ours, but a mammal is a mammal, so it's very likely to have similar processes that describe the very changes that need to happen. And those changes seem to be in the same categories as the one that have been described as, because they're a mix of those apoptosis, you know, cellular cell death, but also immune type response, because you know the immune system plays a big role in the placenta. It's like a weird interference between what is like a foreign body inside the uterus, right? So it has a whole immune, but also because it grows, it needs to have systems in place to stop it growing, to like not basically end up like keep growing and keep growing and keep growing. So it's a very complex, I don't think as scientists even today, people completely understand most of the processes because it's such a complex and fascinating organ. But when I found that new thing, you know, a couple of days ago, that literally there's a scientific paper saying that maturation changes that seem to overlap with what's being described need to happen for placenta detachment.
And then that begs the question then, doesn't it? If we are inducing people early, then what's the impact on the birth and postpartum period if we are forcing labor to start earlier and the placenta hasn't been given the chance to mature and adapt to be able to detach properly, then what's the impact going to be?
And I went to look at that and I found that induction of labor is a known factor for increased feed and placenta. Because that was the first thing that came to my mind when I found this comment and then went to delve into the process. I was like, oh yeah, but if we mess up with that, because we mess up with a lot of things, right? If we mess up with that, then can it detach properly? And you know, it doesn't look like it's been studied in great depth in humans. But again, I'd not be surprised because, you know, in the same way that coming back to the whole patriarchy thing, a few years ago I had a client who lost the ability to have an orgasm after having a cesarean. And when I was a student, I was told that, we don't know the anatomy of women at all as we know the anatomy of men, because history has always been, everything's been done on male bodies, right? And same with animals, and everything's like the man is the standout. And when I, this client had this problem, I went and looked, and they're still the same. So, for instance, if a man has prostate surgery, people are very aware of the nerves because God forbid that the man would lose the ability to have an orgasm. But when women have pelvic surgery, the nerves are not at all as well known. The anatomy of the inside of the abdominal cavity is not at all as well known. I mean, when was it that people finally realized what the anatomy of the clitoris was? 2000?
It's crazy,
It was
isn't
20 years ago, 2003? I can't remember. I remember hearing the press stuff release about that, and I was like, oh my God. And there's still anatomical books today that shows the clitoris as just being the little button, the thing you see on the outside. But today I was listening to midwife Jane Hardwick calling on the podcast, and she was saying if you had a 3D anatomical model of the clitoris, it would not it would difficultly fit, it would make be difficult to fit it in your hand. So there's all this sort of, I don't know how to call it. It doesn't operate in a vacuum. The whole idea of the placenta failing is just a symptom of a culture where we think that we need to protect us against ourselves, and therefore, because in the latest review paper from 2020, the author also has a sentence that jumped to my mind that say they say themselves in their own article that it would take 246 people to be treated to save one baby. That's a lot of people going through induction for nothing. And
And
these are the people who are in favor of this, and they still think it's right. They think that in 2021, I'm sure you were aware of the big uproar of the NICE guideline proposed new induction guidelines that meant that pretty much I wrote a really angry blog about that, and I wrote to NICE, which I'd never done in my life, and I know they got so much backlash that they kind of downplayed the. They didn't make it as bad as they planned to do, but they still brought
the
the.
damage was still done, though. The damage was still done. And my issue with things like telling people or putting guidelines in about, placenta failing or being the wrong body size or being the wrong age. I think a lot of them are defensive guidelines to prevent the worst possible outcomes, which and the percentage chances of those outcomes are very small. And I think we lose sight of that, actually quantifying what the risk of the thing that we're trying to prevent is. And then the research and the guidelines and the people that are making those policies aren't considering the impact that that induction could have on a whole host of other things. I mean, I could talk to you about, I could spend a whole nother hour talking about the impact of induction and the cascade that can happen.
And the fact that it's not communicated to the
No.
parents, people don't make informed decision ever because it's only presented as they're not communicating the risk of the induction. They often dismiss, like, which is now there's actual published research that shows that the rate of induction is doubled, that you have a very high rate of needing a cesarean if you're a first time mother having an induction. But they used to brush it off, saying, oh yeah, there's no risk, and that's not true. We know that's not true. So there's the risk is not discussed. The risk of having the intervention is always the risk of not having it. And then the reality of induction, that's a whole nother topic, because I don't know what it's like in your trust, but in my area I've seen induction being stopped halfway through because there's no room in the delivery unit, and people being made to wait 3 days with nothing happening, in a place where they can't sleep because there's other people around them in a room just with curtains having different stage of induction. Somebody was just telling me the other day as they were going through that, and there was a woman crying constantly next to them.
just
It's just a reality of it. Like if they said to people, okay, well, the people think they're going to have an induction, they're going to think they're going to have the baby the same day, right? And
That's
then
what I thought. That's what I thought with my first. And
it
it was.
sounds very civilized, right? I put the date in my diary, I know when my baby arrived, how convenient. And I mean, I thought it was bad before 2020, but when the lockdowns happened and they wouldn't even let, in 2020, I had a client who was induced for 5 days, ended up with a cesarean. They wouldn't let a partner in, they wouldn't let me in. I mean, I was so distraught by the whole thing. I told my husband, I think I'm done. You know, the next day I had to accompany a client who had been a doula 3 times before. So it was the fourth time I was a doula and I couldn't come in with her. I just came to in front of the hospital to give her a hug before she went in. She went in by herself because she was having a cesarean and her husband wasn't allowed in until she went to theater. I was like, you know, it's madness. It's because some, I know, for instance, a hospital in Surrey never stopped letting doulas in because they made their own risk assessment and they thought very few people have a third birth, you know, a second birth partner, and therefore, in terms of risk, it's neither here nor there. So we're not gonna. Whereas here they said, oh, well, if we let you in, we don't, it's not fair for everybody else. But it's not this whole idea of it needs to be the same rule for everyone never takes into account why people hired an extra supporter, all the emotional issues and anxiety and trauma and whatever have led them to that process. And yeah, it's so dehumanizing, the entire system.
I just think it's very concerning that people are being told that they have to have an induction for whatever reason, whether it's the placenta, whether it's, age, whether it's IVF, which all, by the way, there is questionable evidence to back up all of those reasons. And not being told the impact and the knock-on effect that that could have on their births, on their babies, on their postpartum periods, on their bodies long term, and it's little things which, when I say little, I don't mean little, things that seemingly seem little, which can have a massive impact on somebody. I posted about episiotomies last week. Was it this week? No, it was last week. Posted about episiotomies, and we know that, having medical intervention, the use of drugs and induction, it will increase the chances of an episiotomy, right? And this lady that commented on my post, I posted about the risks and the knock-on effects of episiotomies, and the evidence and the research behind whether they're actually necessary or not. And she said that she's never felt the same down there after her episiotomy. She is in pain, she is in discomfort, and she got told when the doctor checked her out, said, all looks fine, you've healed up fine, it's all in your head. And that
Can
it,
you imagine for 1 second if somebody done that to someone's penis?
I exactly yeah it's
Because
all
one of my theories, and I've talked about that for years, is that when we do a mediolateral episiotomy, we cut into the body of the clitoris. Right? Because I've also had clients who said after an episiotomy that their clitoris was hurting all the time. And that's what led me to look it up. But I mean, when you've got somebody who's been traumatized or injured by the process, having someone then gaslighting them and telling them that it's all in their head, it just adds to their trauma. And to come back to the whole placenta thing, it's very convenient, isn't it? To say, well, your placenta is failing, your placenta is stopping working. And people don't know, right? They don't, they've got no reason to question an expert who says your placenta is failing. That the experts themselves have not gone and reviewed the evidence, they've just taken the guidelines. So it's like a self-perpetuating thing. And yeah, it just.
I mean, I've found from personal experience of supporting people when they're pregnant, quite often the placenta failing justification
Yeah.
is thrown as a last ditch attempt to coerce and just batter somebody into submission because they'll say, oh, you're past your due date and you have a high BMI and you have gestational diabetes and I don't know, whatever else, whatever other reason. And the person's well informed and they're researched and they are confident in most cases with my clients, and they are adamant they do not want the induction. And then the consultant will throw, well, your placenta is going to fail. And you don't want to risk a stillbirth. So it's almost like throw all the reasons at them, and then if they still won't submit, then chuck the placenta failing at them and that will get them to agree. And that's quite a common, I think, common situation that happens, which is why I wanted to record this because I think it's difficult for somebody who's pregnant to go and seek out all that research. If that's what they're inclined to do, to be able to ease their conscience about going against medical advice and saying, no, actually, you know what, I don't want to do that, and actually, I've read all the information, and I'm making an informed decision.
I mean, I've had people messaging me from time to time saying that they're really glad they've read that blog. As far as I know, nobody else has written in that level of depth about this. And that's why the reason I wrote it originally wasn't so much for people who were going to have to face the induction. It was more because birth professionals didn't have I saw discussion happen online where people were being gaslit by medical professionals who took the same attitude they take towards people when they want to coerce them into induction, saying, oh, you don't know what you're talking about. I'm the expert in blah, 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 and use the jargon, throwing jargon at people. And people, and then would talk about this on other groups. And notice that people were saying, I don't know what this person is talking about. And therefore, it's very hard to challenge someone, when you think, okay, they might be right, because that's like beyond my capacity of understanding. And that's what got me so pissed off. And the reason I wrote this originally was to help, birth educators and doulas and midwives and people who just wanted to be having something to make themselves feel able to support people. And this the fact is, it's the most read blog on my entire website.
Where can people find it? Because I will put it in the show notes as well, but where can people
So
find it?
when you Google, so it's on my website in my blog, but I've noticed that the way people find it is when you Google the myth of the aging placenta, you find first Dr. Sarah Wickham's article about it, where she talks about my book,
Signpost to you,
and mine, and she links to my blog in there as well. So it's when I look at my website stats, people don't go to my website to find it, to just go to a web browser search, and now you can search. When I was doing my search, that's a very amusing thing, Erin. When I was doing my research to make sure I was as up to date as possible, and I used an AI academic research tool. And I said, please write me 10 reasons why the placentas age. And then I started looking at all the papers. Please write me the opposite argument. And it's quoted me. I was like, okay, you can't, it's not an academic article, and I never claim it for it to be. But that's the other thing, isn't it? The whole, when you've got doctors who say, oh, well, I don't confuse Google with my medical degree, it really gets my goat, because there are people out there who can do much better research, even though they're not scientists, who can find things and do analysis of stuff for themselves, which is way beyond what most as professional I've ever done. Because, like I said, most people don't have neither the inclination nor the time to go and look at the evidence. They just look at the guidelines, and the guidelines is an interpretation of the current research that's often out of date, because NICE guidelines are only updated once every 5 years, if that. And by the time it's been studied, it's often out of date, but also it's issued by a panel of people whose beliefs are very unlikely to be that, waiting for labor to start on its own. I always remember the waiting for labor to start on its own is a good idea. So all of it is biased from the start, from a very cultural view that birth is dangerous. I always remember a client of mine who was on the eve of her 42nd week, you know, like she was the night before, you know, when you hit midnight and suddenly everything is dangerous. You're low risk at 11:59, you know, 12:01 or 12:00, suddenly you're high risk. There's no gray area.
Yeah.
And this obstetrician was being like, we need to make a plan. It was like crossed arm and like towering over my client. And she said, what's your plan? Meaning, you know, do you want to be induced? And my client said, to give birth. And then the obstetrician faced, I had to look down. So I would have to go. She went into labor that night and had a really beautiful birth.
I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? People are robbed. People are robbed of those experiences because they're strong-armed into intervention, which is, you know, supposedly backed by research. But I think it's telling that when you ask an AI tool, give me the reasons the placenta is aging and give me the reasons the placenta isn't, and it brings up your, you know, it quotes you on the reasons that it's not aging. It's because there's very little information and research out there which counters the argument. And if everybody's focusing on researching, you know, aging placentas and not researching physiological reasons that the placenta, you know, changes, which, you know, you could say is the counter argument or the other view, then of course we're going to have a raft of evidence showing that placentas age.
But also a raft of evidence that might actually be really harmful. I want to make a parallel to that and the campaign against go sleeping that used to be a few years ago and is still kind of in people's consciousness, right? Because, you know, I went to see some new parents last week and they said, oh, we're co-sleeping, but, you know, we've been told we shouldn't, and they're still in there, right? So all this research that was done, if we take the analogy of co-sleeping, because we live in a culture that thinks the norm is for a baby to sleep on their own in a cot, then the research is done. The assumption is made that if anything happened and the baby was in the parent's bed, then the parent's bed is responsible. But that led to a lot of really bad research that was done on population that had high drug usage and high alcohol usage, and that skewed the data, and that led to an entire belief for years and years that is still pervasive in culture now, that somehow it's dangerous, you're going to crush your baby, you're going to smother your baby, this is really bad, you shouldn't be doing it, blah, 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 blah. Actually, the other side of that is it leads to people falling asleep on the sofa with their baby because they've been drilled into them, you shouldn't take the baby to bed, and sleeping on the sofa with their baby is a lot more dangerous than in bed because you could crush the baby. There's a lot more surface for the baby to become entrapped. The research now seems to be slowly evolving, but, you know, my local hospital still has notes saying we don't recommend you. The people were really encouraged to put the baby in that little plastic thingy. We are carrying species. We're not meant to have the baby in a burrow or in a nest. But that it must not go into another soapbox rant about that. But because of that belief, the research went only mostly looking at the danger of co-sleeping, and now we know that the risk of co-sleeping is the same in terms of stillbirth as sleeping with a full-term healthy baby as sleeping in a cot. But there's never been any research to go, half of stillbirths happen in a cot, we should do some research because cots are dangerous. That has never happened. This is the exact same thing. The research on, there is a tiny bit of stuff I found when I found, like I said, a paper that said that it's a normal part of the separation of the placenta. But yeah, when I did that research, it fascinated me. It's all one-sided. And then, of course, research is done and it then self-feed into more research being done, because then the topic becomes like a thing. It becomes fashionable. You know, people think they're being doing something hot and exciting, studying the aging of the placenta. And I really think we should replace the term aging, because the other side of that is we live in a culture that doesn't like aging, especially doesn't like aging in women. You know, the idea that you must stay young, you like must, you know, all the sort of stuff that goes around, like changing, you know, having surgery, having products, having things to keep you looking useful all your life. So that's one aspect of that. But you know, what I've seen in the research tend to indicate I'd like to replace the term aging with maturation, because I think there's something that happens to the placenta. And I've even gone as far as wondering, because there's lots of other papers that link to the same signs of aging happening when there is a premature birth, for instance, or stuff like the baby not growing as big as they should. And I found myself wondering, are those things then the sign that the body's going, this is not happening well, we need to get this baby out? And actually they are the same processes. They are a form of premature maturation rather than aging. Mm-hmm. And that's never been looked at from this angle. Again, the angle is very blinkered. It's because it's looking at it only from the angle, you know, and if you look for something, you're going to find something, right? Yeah. It's just like, that's why I did a friend draw this illustration for the bloggers and placenta with wrinkles and a walking stick and knitted glasses. Because, yeah, you know, if you look for signs of aging, because we're so against the whole idea, and then if you looked for signs of change, if you looked for signs of maturation, if you look like for the processes from a different lens, I'm sure the research would find really different things. And what I also find really fascinating is the first scientist in the UK that I know of, Dr. Fox, which sadly has passed away. He started writing some papers about the aging of the placenta, and then I think the paper was 1997, so a lot of people say, oh, this is an old paper, research has superseded that since. But he says, he sort of backtracks on himself and says there's no reason that placenta should age because they share the genetic material, same genetic material as the baby. Mm-hmm. And he goes on to say that all the histological observation that he interpreted as aging, he thinks he got it wrong, and they were actually, the paper's called Aging of the Placenta, but every time people quote that paper, they're being shut down. They're being gaslit by the people who are doing the more modern research saying it's not true, but they never look at it. And it's really interesting because some of those more recent papers quote Dr. Fox's old papers from 1974, but not that one from 1997 because it goes against the narrative. But they also say that that paper is too old, whilst at the same time quoting papers from 1974, which I find absolutely hilarious. Because I went through when I wrote the original blog, went through with a fine tooth comb many of those papers. I'm like, you don't quote this, you don't quote that. Because when I was doing my PhD, I remember discovering there was another lab in France that did similar things to me. And I said to my boss, but they never quote any of our research. And she said, oh yeah, they see us as competitors and therefore they never do. And you know, we're all guilty of cherry picking. We're all guilty of doing that. You know, I admit I do it, everybody does it. And I talk about that in the blog as well, but being honest with that, you know, being like, I've not seen any willingness online when I've seen debates around that from the people who are the authors of the papers that say present that age, you know, they're so set in their ways. It's not, you know, what the experience I had when I was a scientist in a very niche field and going to very niche conferences, some of us argued until we were blue in the face about tiny little minute topics, but we argued it with good humor. Mm-hmm. But here is what I see with around topics like that is there's no willingness to accept the, and it's attacked, you know, when people go and have discussion around that, it's like, what do you mean? Well, you're like, you know, babies can die if you don't induce, and you mean you want babies to die. You know, I'm exaggerating, but this is kind of the tone of it. It's the same attitude that we see when people are being coerced in consenting to induction because their placenta is failing.
Well, I'm going to signpost everybody to your updated blog because I think it's a really, really easy. I know you wrote it for, you know, birth workers and professionals, but I think it's a really easy read for anybody to understand. And it's really well written and it's got so much, you know, so much information in there. So if people, you know, they can Google you or they can go to sophiemessager.com. M-E-S-S-A-G-E-R.
That's right. Not messenger like people often do. Or the worst of that is being misspelled massager, but
that's one thing you haven't ventured into yet, I'm assuming. Where can the people find you on social media or other platforms if
So
they want?
I'm on both Facebook and Instagram, and the Instagram is very easy because it's Sophie underscore messager, and there's not, luckily in English, my name, because it's French, not very well known. And I think my Facebook page is the Sophie Messager, because it was, again, the name was taken, so it was easier to put that.
Thank you
But I'm
so much.
sure you'll put some link by
Yes,
the,
I'll put all the links on the show notes, and when this goes live on social media, I'll tag you so people can find you and follow you. I feel like I just from talking to you today, I feel like I've got about 10 ideas of other things that I want to talk to you about now. Because
Thank you. Yeah,
it's
and
endless, isn't it?
I know.
Once you start delving into birth and policies and guidelines and how we over intervene and the impact that can have. I mean, I feel like we could talk for days on going into all sorts of different avenues, but I really appreciate your time today. It's been wonderful as ever and
My
educational,
pleasure.
interesting. And yeah, I'll make sure that I signpost everybody to your blog, and thank you so much, Sophie.
Thank you, Irene.
The Better Birth podcast and all of its content is for educational and informational purposes only. You should consult your midwife or your doctor for anything in relation to your own pregnancy and birth. The opinions and the views of the guests on the Better Birth podcast are their own opinions and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Better Birth or Erin Fung.